Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your host for today, Connor Watts, our automotive and battery analyst. I'm joined by our hydrogen analyst and editor, Bogdan Avramusa.
Hello.
And by our solar analyst, Andreas Fontenot.
Hello.
In this week's episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about a new report that we've just released about virtual power plants, how that name isn't entirely accurate, and their influence over the energy grid of the future until 2040. Then we're going to be talking about a certain $39 billion bid from BHP for Anglo American, why that happened and what it means. And finally, we're going to be talking about liquid hydrogen and its hidden appeal as a as an energy carrier. So, Andreas, you take the floor on this one.
Yeah, so like you said, there's actually some uncertainty around the near-term virtual power plant. Some of the companies I spoke to for this report even preferred to avoid using the term, and maybe in a few years it'll get replaced by a different term. But what there definitely is a need for more control and more decision-making around when to discharge batteries. Because just think about it. If you invest in a battery, you don't want to be in a situation where you discharge it too early and then you're left with a period in which you don't have green power and you're drawing off the grid. And this is true whether you're residential or commercial and industrial or even the grid itself may be firing up gas peakers. So you don't want to discharge it too early. You also don't want to leave it charged when maybe you could have discharged and got some extra money because you were too conservative, because you've paid for the infrastructure and now you want to use it as intensively as possible. So in other words, you need to have forecasting of what the demand is going to be over the next day or sometimes multiple days and what the supply is going to be. So that includes weather forecasting. It can include a lot of other things like demand response. It can be thought of as a kind of supply in a sense, or even vehicle-to-grid charging in the future. I mean, some of these companies that I've spoken to for this report already cover like dozens of different generation and demand assets. Now, I probably still haven't said what VPP is. Have I said the words virtual power plant yet?
You've said so that people don't actually like it as a term.
So. Some of them don't. But anyway, I like it enough to use it as the title of my latest forecast. It's an aggregation. It's an aggregation of batteries, demand response, wind, solar, really as many different things as you can find to throw in there. You aggregate it online under some software. The software does the forecasting. The software chooses when to dispatch the batteries depending on the forecasting. That's basically what it comes down to. And it really is all about that optimization of battery storage capacity, both in financial terms and in terms of reliability of green power supply.
So it sounds like the potential for VPPs is quite large, Andreas. Is that correct?
Well, exactly, because I usually, almost out of preference, try to write about physical infrastructure, physical things like polysilicon or the investment cost of a factory or transmission lines. Well, that's more your topic these days, but it's a great example of the physical constraints on the grid, on the energy transition. VPPs, though, are software. They're literally software. They're a software framework. They require the internet. They require a financial and regulatory framework as well. Well, there isn't this manufacturing constraint on them. There isn't a physical constraint. So when you try to answer the question of how prevalent will they be in 2040, there's not really a limiting factor. There's not a marginal cost to expand it. Not really much of a marginal cost to just run a piece of software they're already running and just apply it to more assets that are internet connected. So I think it will grow to become at least a plurality of the grid. It depends which market you're looking at, but you know, the numbers are in the report if you want to look at them. So obviously one of the best things for a battery is to have, you don't want to be stuck in a sense on solar, and then if there's a bad day for solar generation, you're just kind of ruined. You also want to have some access to wind and all the other asset types that I spoke of. One of the companies I spoke to was Eneco, which is a Dutch utility. They already have wind power in their virtual power plant. And that's interesting because mostly VPPs are still the distributed solar plus storage. You know, that's part of the story is you're making a power plant out of lots of different distributed small scale assets and you're aggregating them into one more manageable thing that can you know, have a single centralized point of control. And the fact that Eneco already has the wind power is quite, I thought that was very interesting. It just shows the lack of any restriction in principle on how much they can grow. So in the future, they'll be very big. Right now, they do have a lot of obstacles. One obstacle is simply that people maybe don't bother to sign up, because a VPP doesn't give you the battery. It just optimizes the battery. So the profit in absolute terms is not huge. So, for example, I could I have a domestic solar and storage system, and I could sign up for a VPP. I probably will. I just personally haven't bothered to yet, because it doesn't really matter very much. I've been busy. So I think that is an example of one obstacle to sign up. I think I've written it in an article in the past few months. There's a VPP in, I think it was Ontario, Canada, and the reward for people signing up is like a free $75 gift card in the first year and then $20 a year thereafter. So that's one thing, is just getting the customers to sign up. Now, in future, when people are buying EVs, I think that will be one major way to get people to automatically sign up instead of nagging them about the $20 they could have per year. Because when you have the EV, suddenly that's a single unitary big electricity expense. And if you have a lot of variable power prices on the grid, which again feeds back to the importance of batteries, you want to discharge at the right time because of the variable power prices. Well, if you're buying an EV, then suddenly it might make sense to think about that for the first time in terms of domestic consumption. And you also have a big new piece of grid technology that has probably internet connection capability. So that can be a big platform for people to sign up in the future. Where am I going with this? You got any questions?
Well, I have a question with regards to that. Okay, so the effective size of a VPP, obviously it becomes more sophisticated with more assets and with access to, let's say, larger capacities of both generation and of kind of immediately dispatchable energy. I'm thinking about this in the sense of trading markets, because, frankly, if we have something that's going to be interacting with the energy grid, there's going to be VPPs in competition with one another, and algorithmically, they're going to need to be kind of interacting, aren't they? So it won't just be one VPP to rule them all, because it would create a monopoly and it would never actually dispatch energy into the grid until it was so needed that the energy prices had gone up an obscene amount to make all the profit. The concern with this is that it lends itself quite heavily to consolidation. And so I am looking for a little bit more regulation in the sense of market competitiveness, because when it comes to trading markets and such, the kind of opacity of it and the concentration of firms competing with one another lends itself to, let's just say, shady operations. So I'm just going to be saying that when it comes to VPPs, I would like to see a little bit more knowledge of it from governments and the kind of potential it has to kind of distort energy generation.
And there are individual VPP companies that write their own software and they're aiming to be a VPP company. I think in the future, though, they will tend to get taken over by the utilities, though, like you say, a big deal is what the regulations say about how the market will work. So, you know, we can't really comment too much on that because it's all quite new. But I think you look at the utilities and they have the means and the opportunities to take it over. They also have a big motive, not just to find a new profit source, but also to protect their existing profit source, their existing presence on the grid as the people who run the grid and supply power, which VPPs threaten. So I guess it will vary.
Yeah, that's a good point. So when it comes to VPPs and just the sheer size of them, let's say for somewhere like Europe, is this just not replacing the kind of interconnection capabilities in between countries? Because technically speaking, I imagine there will be a regulatory barrier to this, but just theoretically speaking, what is stopping a VPP from being completely cross-border, from having a bunch of assets in Spain and, oh, Germany needs power, and setting up a kind of distributive network that makes use of assets in a cheaper country where maybe project development is cheap, but it's making use of kind of excess demand in another country where it's got a higher industrial presence.
I mean, there's already some utilities that work across borders. I think Eneco, that I already mentioned, is one of them. So, yeah, I don't see why, in theory, especially when it's under the aegis of the overall European Union, I don't see why not. Might have an easier time than trading across different electricity markets in the US, for all I know.
I was going to say, yeah, Texas will be an interesting one there. So that gives, you mentioned Eneco, they're going to have a significant wind portfolio, aren't they? What we've seen, or what we've usually seen with regards to the kind of portfolio, as it were, the portfolio of distributed energy is solar plus batteries, as you mentioned. And with a VPP, you can effectively tailor the portfolio like you would, say, a stock tracker or that sort of thing, to give you certain characteristics within the VPP of this is when we generate, this is when we restock, based on the kind of energy, well, based on the available assets, obviously. But it would be optimizing that and towards certain markets. So no VPP is going to be exactly the same. It's the way that I'm looking at this. You're going to have VPPs where there's wind assets because they're available, and the curtailed energy from that is going into a battery, and the battery is then being sold into Germany or Poland or some other industrial country where that fits. But again, another angle of this is the environmental side of things. Most companies are going to be going for this highly, highly renewable portfolio because you're taking the curtailed energy, you're putting it into batteries, and then you can sell it towards companies or countries that are in need of energy but don't want to be using the gas peaker plants because of the associated CO2 emissions.
Hmm.
Is that accurate? What's the environmental impact of all this?
So that is definitely interesting. I think that should bring us actually to one of the big numbers in the report related to a set of physical assets, which is psychologically a relief to talk about. So obviously with stationary batteries in both the distributed and the utility scale, their typical duration is 4 hours. So they're more really about smoothing out the renewable generation within a given day, maybe multi-day if you're lucky or you build an awful lot of batteries or you get flow batteries. But I think when you look at really clamping down on the use of the gas peakers, even beyond single or multi-day to maybe the week-long time frame, it might be quite interesting that there's a lot of vehicle-to-grid potential. And the way I approach this report, because the vehicle-to-grid batteries, EVs are going to be at least as common, probably more common, than domestic battery installations. And they're much individually far bigger in terms of the sheer size of their battery. So if you have a crisis on the grid, which the Germans call Dunkelflaute, where it's poor solar conditions and poor wind conditions for several days at a stretch, maybe the grid will actually be kept alive in large part due to the electric vehicle fleet discharging onto the grid. Now, this is something that comes into play more in the late 2030s and onwards. So it's a bit future-oriented. But a big way that I wrote this report was not by looking at the scattered 50 megawatt to 100 megawatt dozens and dozens of VPPs that now exist. And it's all sort of notional and all based around customer sentiment and regulatory approvals and how much power price variation there is in the day. It would be a bit hard to take that and extrapolate and decide where things end up. Instead, my mentality was more like, well, what if you didn't have VPPs? A grid in 10 or 20 years without VPPs would be absurd because it wouldn't be controlling the discharge, the timing of battery discharge, according to the monitoring and forecasting of demand and supply. That's really all a VPP is it determines the battery discharge based on a huge data feed-in from all of these intermittent sources. When you're running a grid on coal, it's simple. You just ramp the coal up and down so that it's always fitting how much demand there is. When you've got all these intermittent sources and all these different categories of battery and variable power prices all over the place and half a dozen different power markets or something, then you do need this kind of software.
Mm, very true.
And this kind of aggregation on a vast scale.
So to follow up from Connor's last point, from a technological point of view, because you said you spoke with a number of companies, do you see sort of a unity in what they all bring technology-wise, or the differences in the different pieces of software they're working on? Do you see a need for the future market, VPP market, to be unified in what the standards are for what technology is brought to the table, or is that irrelevant?
Yeah, a big thing that probably all of them said, certainly some of them, was the need for just standardization across the equipment. They want to be able to plug all of these different pieces of equipment like solar inverters or electric vehicles into an API. And to some extent, they can't. And every time they go to a new place or a new type of asset, they have to write a whole new piece of software, and it's all a huge nuisance. So that's definitely one issue. The other thing about technology was control hubs. So some of them are building control hubs. Others just plan to find ways to fit their technology into the onboard hardware on inverters, on electric vehicles, and so on. The other thing about like how these companies vary is that, you know, some of them are already utilities. Some of them are sort of middlemen who will only provide the software, and they might control VPPs, but they won't own them, and they'll be trying to make themselves useful to the utilities. Some utilities are pretty crusty and old. They're not famous for their ability to write brand new software with a really nice user interface. So I think there is a big role for at least quite a while for bespoke software companies making themselves useful to the actual owners of the thing. Then another thing is microgrids. Like a couple of these companies that I spoke to, as mentioned before, don't even like the term VPP. They call themselves microgrid. And that makes a lot of sense. And this brings me to yet another aspect of just why VPPs are so relevant. They're not just relevant to battery energy storage, which will be the most crucial part of an intermittent-based power grid. It's also via the transmission, via the energy storage aspect. It's also related to optimizing the usage of transmission lines. Aggregating half a dozen or even a dozen different types of supply and demand is something you already need to do in some cases in remote places that are off-grid. Like back when I was interviewing a couple of years back, the concentrated solar power company Vast in Australia, so that their technology has a huge long-duration energy storage. And one of their first projects is out in, I think, Mount Isa in rural Queensland. To power this town, they're not just doing the CSP. They've also got gas peaking, which they try to avoid using. They've got batteries. They've probably got PV, and all of the management and forecasting software for that is effectively a VPP, but they call it a microgrid because it is a microgrid. So if utilities can have a bunch of VPPs that are effectively working as microgrids and localizing the supply, it means they can skip out on, you know, tens of billions of dollars of transmission line build-out. I think that was something that was actually published by the Energy Information Administration recently, although it's kind of obvious when you think about it. I think they published like 100 something on within an order of magnitude of $100 billion dodged if you have VPPs working as microgrids across the US. So I think we've covered a lot of the different bases of why VPPs are relevant.
Mm-hmm. Good to hear. And if anybody is interested in looking further at this report, it's available for purchase on our website at rethinkresearch.biz. Go to Energy, hit the report, you'll be prompted to speak with one of their people, and we'll go from there. Moving on, I think, because we did spend quite a good while on that, I'm going to talk a little bit about, just in brief, about an unsolicited bid in the mining industry that would have been, had it gone through, $39 billion. This was a bid from BHP, the world's largest miner, to purchase the entirety of Anglo American before kind of divesting certain parts of it. I'm just going to go over a couple of the assets that Anglo American has and why the bid was declined. So Anglo American had a rough year last year. 2023 saw its end of year profit drop 94% from $4.5 billion to, I believe, to about $240 million. USD. And so its share price over the last year and a half, 2 years, has fallen by about 50%. Other mining companies have remained roughly level or have increased over this time. So the valuation of this company has taken quite a massive hit over the last couple of years. This has mostly been because of its a combination of its platinum group metal assets and its diamond assets, because Anglo American owns a majority of De Beers, which operates in Botswana, I believe. I could be wrong on that. Anyways, those assets are worth Not a lot at the moment, and Anglo-American has taken significant impairments on their profitability. However, Anglo-American also owns significant copper assets, which is more or less the sole reason that BHP is interested in it, along with some nickel, which isn't doing great at the moment, and some metallurgical coal, which BHP was also interested in. So the bid for $39 billion was a bit cheeky and was never realistically going to be accepted, because even if we assume just a kind of level copper price over the next few years and no expansions in production for its copper assets, that $39 billion would have repaid itself over just under 15 years by my maths, and that's not a fair bid, that when you can literally just sell off all the other assets and keep the copper, which was not really BHP's plan, but it wasn't far off it.
So what was BHP's motivation for the bid?
Acquiring more copper for exposure into the energy transition markets. So BHP is already one of the largest copper producers in the world, but it wants more, quite understandably, because the current supply-demand outlook for copper, I wrote about this this week as well. Antofagasta's CEO claimed that the world is set to enter a deficit this year when it comes to copper supply versus demand, and that the incentive price hasn't even been hit. So he claims that the incentive price for the development of new copper mines is $12,000 per ton. Meanwhile, a few other institutions, I believe Goldman Sachs, claims that the incentive price is closer to $15,000 per ton to develop new mines. It's currently just sub 10. It's been hovering around that for a couple of weeks now. But anything else gets worse in the kind of supply-demand environment, and we'll see it go above 10 pretty quickly, I think. So yeah, that was its motivation for the bid. It was declined because, one, it was a little kind of cheeky on the valuation, but it does kind of put forward the idea of Anglo-American as this acquirable asset. And so people are thinking about, well, who else could buy this company? And I'm going to argue nobody, because it has too many assets that are in weird geopolitical states. So its PGM business is based pretty significantly out of South Africa. And South African regulators like having Anglo-American in the country, and they wouldn't sign off on anybody else purchasing it and divesting those assets away from the country, because it would mean less investment towards the PGM side of things, and maybe less kind of even like maintenance and such while prices are low. It has other assets in South Africa, it might be iron ore, I forget. But effectively, BHP didn't want that to... Well, BHP had no interest in the South African assets of Anglo-American. Its plan was literally, we're going to buy Anglo-American, we're going to keep the good bits, and we're going to sell the bad bits. The bad bits are mostly in South Africa because of its general problems socially, and because of the unreliability of Eskom, its energy grid.
So where does this leave Anglo-American?
It's effectively, Anglo-American's portfolio is built in such a way that it needs a significant recovery in either the price of PGMs, the price of diamonds, a further increase in the price of copper. A recovery in nickel would be nice, but it doesn't actually make that much, to be perfectly honest. Metallurgical coal is already doing quite well. The bad thing for it is that it's already doing reasonably well, and I don't have much faith for the diamond market, just because it's a weird one, but it's mostly linked to the jewelry sector, but there is also a significant kind of displacement when it comes to moissanite and lab-grown kind of diamonds. I think the PGM market is interesting in that it has both, and well, it has a proportional kind of increase and decrease from the automotive sector and from its new reliance on electrolyzers and use as a catalyst for electrolysis as opposed to the conversion of harmful emissions out of tailpipe stuff. I was on about the forecast number as opposed to its price. And so the price of PGMs has been quite low for a while, and it would do well to see a recovery there. So Anglo-American, it could also be, well, it would also be very happy if it found a market for its incredibly expensive fertilizer mine in England. So it's producing something called polyhalite as a replacement for potash, which is mined pretty everywhere and is what most fertilizers are made from. This polyhalite mine, it claims, will be lower cost and higher efficacy than potash-based fertilizers, but it requires another, I believe, $7.5 billion to come online, and it took a $1.5 billion impairment on it last year, because when you're developing a mine, you don't actually develop any ore, or you don't actually produce any ore until the mine is complete.
So I have a sort of broad question. I have a broad question about, like, why does this matter? Does the fortune of Anglo-American merely reflect events in demand and supply for all of these ores and metals? Or does the fate of a big mining company to some extent drive what happens? Like, if Anglo-American has a hard time, does that mean it will not be investing, and then a decade down the line there'll be more of a shortage?
It's a little bit of both. Mining companies are some of the most cash-rich companies in the world. They're very, very old-fashioned. And so this kind of massive acquisition is rare, but it's not, like, completely rare. I'd say you're right in both ways, but I wrote about this mostly because it shows a recognition from wider industry that copper is becoming a problem, and owning it is a very, very good thing if you can produce it. So, especially at a low cost. So, I believe Anglo's copper operations are in Latin America. I could be misremembering that. And they're generally quite low cost, and it is increasing in production output, which isn't the case for a lot of copper producers. It's a lot easier to buy copper mines right now than it is to make a new one, because we've had the cancellation of Cobre Panama, because the government said no just as it was finishing up. That removed a few hundred thousand tons from global supply. Anglo-American's copper mines have been producing for a long time and will continue producing for a long time. They're in a good state in that regard. And so BHP wants that because it has faith in the kind of rising demand from the energy transition. It's kind of bumping up the price to increase BHP's profit as a result of that. I was kind of just going through its assets to say, even with all these horrific assets, $39 billion was a cheeky bid. And so it will need to be significantly higher than that for my company to be able to do it. But even if a company existed which was able to put a higher bid in than that, competition regulators would say no. Would say, okay, no. You need to be two companies now, because this is far too much control over a single asset. BHP acquiring Anglo-American would give it over 10% of the world's copper supply. And that's not a path that regulators want to be going down, because as soon as a shortage crops up, BHP retracts some of its... as soon as a surplus shows up, BHP can just hold inventories for a little while, wait for it to go down, and because it controls 10% of supplies, it has significant influence on price. So, my opinion on this is that Anglo-American isn't going to get acquired unless it itself kind of divests some of the less profitable business units and sold those off to whoever will buy them. And so it'll just be kind of in somewhat limbo for a little while until there's a bit of a market uptick in its failing assets, because it's not struggling for cash from what we know. So it can last a good while on worse market fundamentals. Anyways, let's just continue on from there. Bogdan, you wrote about liquid hydrogen as a long-distance hydrogen transport method this week. Could you just explain say the logic behind that?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, liquid hydrogen ammonia and liquid organic hydrogen carriers are probably the three options for economically transporting hydrogen on ships over large distances. Of course, the last one that I mentioned, liquid organic hydrogen carriers, that's a category. So that's multiple other compounds included in that, like toluene or methyl cyclohexane, MCH. Regardless, there's a variety of sort of compounds and states in the case of liquid hydrogen that have potential when it comes to long distance hydrogen transportations over ships. And of course, they all have sort of benefits and negatives. And the unified decision, I'm saying unified because sort of a unified between analysts, ourselves included, we, I think, never saw liquid hydrogen as really a high potential carrier or transport option for hydrogen. But a new sort of perspective sort of arrived. I came across it, and that's what motivated me to write the article, to sort of present the, like I said in the title, the hidden appeal of liquid hydrogen as a carrier. So the whole premise is that liquid hydrogen has never sort of been preferred by any by anyone, or rather by most people, because of its extremely low cryogenic required temperature. So hydrogen becomes liquid at -253°C. So it takes a great deal of energy to cool down gaseous green hydrogen to -253°C, to then liquefy it, put it in a tank, and then maintain that temperature of -253°C over the duration of the trip, compared to ammonia, which is liquid at about -20°C. So significantly less, but it takes more energy. But it also takes a significant amount of energy to convert hydrogen into ammonia or hydrogen into one of the LOHCs that I mentioned before, the liquid organic hydrogen carriers. So it sort of becomes a sort of a maths question of how much does it cost to convert hydrogen in either of those things, how much the cost ranks up proportional to the distance, given the energy requirements to maintain those low temperatures, and then how much energy does it take to reconvert that carrier back into hydrogen. So there's obviously a couple of possibilities, a couple of different scenarios. But essentially, the whole premise of the article, the hidden appeal of liquid hydrogen as a carrier, is that it doesn't really require any energy at the end destination to be converted back into hydrogen, because you can just exchange heat with the ambient environment to bring the temperature back up to room temperature. So then the liquid hydrogen becomes gaseous again, like I said, with an extremely small cost in energy. So why is this relevant? Because if we assume a scenario where the destination country suffers from, let's say, high energy and electricity prices, then even if you manage to convert the hydrogen into ammonia or an LOHC at lower price than liquid hydrogen at the sort of a packing country, the start of the journey, then if you get to the destination and then you need to do ammonia cracking or dehydrogenation to get hydrogen out of ammonia or an LOHC, if that cost is significantly higher because of high energy prices in the destination country compared to negligible energy costs for converting liquid hydrogen into gaseous hydrogen, that this is where sort of the overall maths question or the balance is the potential in the case of liquid hydrogen to undercut ammonia or LOHC. So this is a more sort of a niche new perspective that I came across, which I think it's sound and has some potential, which is why some companies are pursuing liquid hydrogen carriers like Total Energies, and the Japanese government is quite keen on it.
Right. So when it comes to the kind of comparison between liquid hydrogen and LOHCs, the main factors, just to kind of reiterate, energy prices at the scene of conversion, so at the kind of end point energy prices, because something like ammonia will need converting back into hydrogen, most likely. Is distance a significant factor? Because the longer, I'm thinking about this in the terms of maritime transport as a kind of LNG substitute. That's generally how I think of hydrogen transport.
Yep.
So time at sea is going to be time where liquid hydrogen needs to be kept at negative 253 Celsius, as you say. Yep. Or lower, but no reason to. And so that's going to be expending energy costs for the duration of said trip, while something like ammonia or an LOHC is going to be spending significantly less energy to maintain its state of either, you mentioned ammonia was a liquid at minus 20?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You can do that with a pretty regular refrigerant. So, so it's going to be electricity costs at the site of conversion, and it will be distance at sea. What other factors are influencing the calculation here?
Yes, obviously distance has an impact. Like you said, you need to refrigerate those things at different temperatures. So the longer the distance, the more energy you'll require to spend on maintaining such low temperatures. But again, there's so many scenarios, right? Because you can have green hydrogen, say from Africa, made relatively cheaply. You use the Haber-Bosch process to manufacture ammonia, and then you ship that into Europe. If you want to use it as ammonia, then obviously it makes sense to just, you don't need to crack it back into hydrogen, just use it as ammonia. And then if you take into account all the possibilities of origin for the green hydrogen and usage, so that's in the country of destination, there's so many possibilities and so many sort of different scenarios where one will be better than the other. And then in the next scenario, it'll be reversed. It really depends on the practicalities and the actual agreements and necessities and availability and etc.
Reading this, if hydrogen is getting transported, then almost by definition, that allows the hydrogen production to migrate to places with cheap electricity. And what you're saying here is that the conversion cost of liquid hydrogen is all about, it all occurs at the place of generation when it gets turned into a liquid, which we've just said would be low cost because that's where the hydrogen production migrates to.
Mm.
So it almost seems like a truism that if hydrogen gets transported, then liquid hydrogen will dominate. You're accepting that the local cost at the place of creation will be low electricity prices, and then you're sending it to places which tend usually to have high electricity prices.
Mm.
So you like a form of hydrogen where you don't need to do a process, you just let it warm up. I mean, that might be incorrect.
In a controlled manner.
Yeah, exactly, in a controlled manner, but more or less what you said. I wouldn't go as far as saying it will dominate, because like I said, there's the sort of the comparison and the balance is quite complex, right? There's a lot of things affecting the different parts of transportations that we mentioned, right? If hydrogen is produced in a country with low electricity prices, so it can be produced economically, then sure, the conversion into liquid hydrogen will also be competitive, but then you also need to transport it, right? And then you need to maintain that minus 253 Celsius temperature, and that obviously skews the balance a bit.
Interject. There's also the safety application. So if a ship cannot maintain the minus 253 Celsius for whatever reason, kind of, it's going to be a closed system, obviously, but there's a reason hydrogen is known to be quite volatile and changing phases.
That's why, like I mentioned in the article, you have companies sort of pouring a lot of money and effort into building new ships capable of doing it, right?
So that's a very expensive mistake, is all I'm really saying. Allowing it to, okay, right, you can't get that wrong. It because this is compressing an obscene right. amount of hydrogen into a liquid, at which point, if there's any kind of... There will be no room for error when it comes to maintaining said low temperature. There will be no... In the same sense that you can't stop cooling a nuclear reactor.
Of course, which is why the... of course, which is why the sort of the capex of those shifts will probably be significant. And this is where the... You know, the impact on the price of how much it costs to transport hydrogen as liquid hydrogen will have an impact. But like I said, ammonia, there's still a big market for ammonia, so you will plenty of producers and off-takers who want to take advantage of said low electricity and energy locations to not only produce the hydrogen but also convert it straight into ammonia and then ship it as ammonia, use it as ammonia, right? So that's not going to go away. There's no better alternative, because obviously if you ship it as ammonia and use it as ammonia, there's no need for a process to then crack it back into hydrogen. So the cost is zero at the destination place. But yeah, so like I said, the balance is quite complex. The math is quite complex. There's a lot of factors influencing those things. And given how many scenarios are of, you know, countries of origin, countries of destination, methods of transportation, we can't really rule out anything. So I wouldn't go as far as saying it will dominate, but I think it has a place.
I think that's a good way to end that part. Just a couple short items from this week's issue.
Can I jump in with one?
Yeah, of course.
Because I think it was last week or the week before where I said, oh yes, well, polysilicon price will decline until it hits the marginal cost of production. And then it'll bump along there. And mm-hmm. you disagreed. You said, no, it can go below. Mm-hmm. And they'll try to kill off the people with the best marginal cost of production, or simply the biggest financial reserves, will be happy to go below and just kill off all the competition. I've been quoted in other outlets as saying, oh, yes, it'll be above $5.50 per kilogram for the rest of this year, and it's just bloody well fallen to $5.40. So I'm very much hoping that is... below marginal cost, like I think it is, and that it will probably therefore end up rising again by the end of this year, and I'll look like less of a dipstick. But anyway, so I just wrote an article looking at, you know, if you spend a couple of years selling polysilicon for several times the marginal cost of production, logically, that could fund you being below the marginal cost of production by a little bit for really a whole decade. And I actually did the maths. But I won't go into that because we're into the short part. But I just wanted to say you were right.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. But, okay, so my point for this week was just that an Indonesian company, which is an Indonesian coal company, has now committed to no longer invest in more fossil fuels whatsoever. And that's very good news, broadly speaking. Because Indonesia's energy grid is heavily, heavily dominated by coal. And so it's 98% or something because they have ridiculous coal reserves that are very, very cheap. And it employs a lot of people, so there's a resistance to kind of replacing that. But this group has been in partnership with China's Tsingshan Group. And they are They're a nickel miner and processor with a lot of operations in Indonesia and in the Chinese mainland. And so instead of investing in coal, it's going to be strategically investing in more nickel mines in the country, which environmentally speaking isn't very good because Indonesia's nickel reserves are quite low purity. Not low purity, they're quite low grade. And so that it's going to require high pressure acid leaching facilities, which is Tsingshan's specialty. So it will be more low cost nickel on the horizon for Indonesia, but less coal, which is a silver lining. What I'm effectively saying here is I don't see a point where the nickel market really recovers from the side of Indonesia, because as supply increases for Indonesia, which is already over 50%, there isn't an economical price point for sulfide resources or for less environmentally damaging nickel mines to kind of establish themselves at a price point that makes them any money. So I will be watching that like a hawk, waiting for some regulation to bring in the necessary conditions, but I think that might take a little bit of time. On that note, I think it's okay to end here. So I'd like to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you tune in again next week. So goodbye for now.